Welcome, everybody. I'm Jeffrey Lappendorf, Executive Director of the Community of Literary Magazines and Press at CLMP. If you don't know us, visit us at clmp.org. We have been around for 50 years, helping small publishers through the business of publishing. And the reason we help small publishers is because small publishers publish great writers that are not always the most commercially viable, but we want to make them as not as commercially viable as possible, but to have them reach as many readers as possible. That sometimes means the same thing. Sometimes there's a happy confluence of planets. I'm going to say something I say at all of these kind of convenings. This is a small room, so it's not so bad, but I'll still invite all of you or any of you to move up, to come on up. There's a truism. You've got some, you know, fancy people here in front of you. I'm not counting myself. I'm not fancy, but we have some very fancy people. And the fact is that if you sit up front, we're not going to embarrass you. You can still get up and leave early. It's fine. We're impervious to insult. However, you might just look familiar the next time one of these folks sees you. And the truism is that familiarity tends to equal liking or thinking better of. And that means if one of these folks is in a situation where they might directly do you some good, there we go. They're not going to go, oh, that was that person from the second row at AWP. They're going to go like, do I know you? Why do I know you? I must like you. So I think we'll hand you the grant check. So I'm just saying, it's up to you. Yeah, there you go. Okay. Sometimes, you know, there's a lot of great writers, and not everyone can get the centerfold in the catalog. So sometimes just showing up is a little bit of the battle. Ultimately, you have to be a great writer, but all these little things help. We want to give you every possible advantage tip and trick we can. So welcome to There's Waldo, Marketing a First Book. I'm going to ask a silly question. Who here's a writer? Great, you're in the right place. All right, so who already has had or published a first book? Great, and who is in the process of? Oh, fantastic. And I'm hoping everyone else plans to at some point in their writing lives. Okay, excellent. I'm going to introduce our panel to you. We'll start with Nicole at the end. I'm going to ask each panelist, and then I may say more about you if you don't say what I want you to say. I'm going to ask each panelist to self-introduce in no more than two breaths.
Let's see if I can do this. So I am the co-board chair of the CLMP, and I am also run a publicity agency that works on books and book adjacent things, and I spent 20 years inside of publishing houses doing that, most recently as the associate publisher at Little Brown.
That was impressive. I mean, not just impressive, but impressive you could say that in such a little short amount of time. We'll talk about elevator speeches lately, but take note.
Nicole Dewey.
My name is Jane Friedman. I've spent 20 years in the publishing industry, books, magazines, commercial, literary, and I have a new book out, The Business of Being a Writer, which is supposed to help writers at all levels with the business side of publishing.
I am Rosamond S. King. I am a creative and critical writer and performer. My first collection of poetry is Rock, Salt, Stone from Nightboat Books, booth 1034. And 2 days ago, I found out that I'm a finalist for the Lambda Literary Award. So I have I'm living the dream of having a gold sticker on the front of my book.
And before we get going, as sort of a way to sort of bless the crowd, I've asked Rosamond if she would just do a number from her book, read a poem from her book. This is it right here. And while she's selecting something, and this is Jane's book here, which officially hasn't been published yet, but it really has, and so you can actually buy it here at AWP before any, you'll know all the secrets before any of your friends do, if you pick it up here. You'll be a few days ahead of all your friends trying to get books out there. I do want to say also that Rosamond took part in a CLMP program called Face Out, Maximizing the Visibility of Emerging Writers. It's a two-year program. It's funded by the Jerome Foundation, mostly, that has authors with their publishers going through a number of workshops and spending time with each other toward really partnering and getting a book out there. So we'll talk about, in particular with Rosamond, how she worked with her publisher not just in a vacuum, to get her book out there. But Rosamond, take it away.
I can't read poetry sitting down.
And postcards of my book are going around partly to market my book, but partly as an example to you of a type of marketing for the book. This is from the first poem in the book, which is called Bring Back. My eshu lies over the ocean. My ocean lies inside the sea. A bhikkhu cries down by the river. Don't bring back that body to me. Bring back. My bonnet flies along with ocean. My bonnet lies under the sea. A billion cries sent through my eshu. Please bring back ra body to me. My nyamo came over the ocean. My ocean lives inside of me. With eshu there why I'm still living. This story flows into the sea. Bring back.
Thank you for that. You know, this isn't a poetry workshop, but thank you for reminding us that poetry and song are one. So we're going to dive right in toward marketing a first book. So I'm just going to ask a very broad question to begin, and anyone can jump in. When do you first start marketing a book?
I'll jump in. I think you can start marketing a book the minute that you become a writer. And if you think about it in that way, you are thinking about building an audience from the very beginning. So if you're being a participant in the literary community, if you're going to other people's readings, if you are reading other people's works, if you are commenting on them and sharing them on social media, you're doing kind of the first baby steps of building your audience.
Yeah, so much of good marketing is built on a foundation that's been forming for years. So even things that you wouldn't consider part of your marketing plan, which we'll get into with the author questionnaire, suddenly you know play a role in how you get noticed or how word spreads. So the relationships you're forming in creative writing programs, for instance, can play a huge role in your marketing.
So I'm going to ask a little more pointed question for Rosamond. So Rosamond, what was the actual publication date of your book?
The official publication date was last year, was 2017. I think it was May, but it was unofficially launched at AWP in March.
Right. So March is when the book was kind of available, essentially.
Yes.
Okay. And so did your marketing begin then? When did you really do anything that went beyond in your head about letting someone know about this book?
If the book came out in March of 2017, I would say August of 2016. Was when we started sending things actually out into the world, contacting people, letting them know that it would be coming to them. They might want to review it. Yeah.
Great. And do you feel like before the book was really a book, that you were marketing it perhaps, or getting word out about it?
I mean, I think in retrospect, I was. I think as writers, we often think marketing is one of those evil things that interrupts the muse and, you know, taints the perfect world of creativity. But I think when you meet people and they say, oh, you're a writer, what are you working on? That your response to that is actually marketing. Because you could say, oh, I'm working on some poems. Or you could say, I'm working on a collection that's examining the contemporary experiences of women in the United States. And then people are like, oh. So then when they think, oh, there's a special issue of such and such coming out on women's writing, then they know to contact you, as opposed to kind of a generic person who writes generic poems, which none of us write generic.
and just maybe to back up a little bit toward what we're starting to already hear a lot about, just to give folks some definitions. So we've heard about, even in the tiniest way so far, things that happen before a book even really comes out, and things that happen in the most general way toward building, I don't know if we use the word platform yet, but of having some sort of identity out there. And we heard a bit about some things that happen around a book before it actually comes out, who it might go to, why, and then what perhaps maybe happens after the book is out that you still can do. So can someone just give a little, maybe get a couple brass tacks definitions, pre-pub, post-pub, just a little bit about the dividing line between those two kinds of marketing and maybe what's different about pre-publication marketing and post-publication marketing.
So the pre-publication marketing, you know, is anything that happens from what we were talking about, the point that you become a writer, and what Rosman said is right. If you can be specific from the very beginning about what you're writing, if you're in your description of your writing, kind of defining your audience, you are helping to build that audience, you are helping to focus your community. And everything that happens pre-publication is up until the publication date. I do think that the publication dates in big publishers are much more definite than they can be for, you know, small literary presses that have much more fungible dates. So not important to get too caught up on that. Post-publication is everything that happens after the book is out in the world and people can actually get the book. So pre-publication, you're building buzz, you're building awareness, you're building your audience, you're building your platform, and hopefully maybe driving pre-order sales. And at, you know, at publication, it's much more focused on not just the piece that you are saying about, so, and maybe this is an important definition, because the way that I've always defined the difference between publicity and marketing is what you or your publisher say about you and your work to the world. And what publicity says, what publicity is what other entities say about you and your work to the world. And that's, that publication time, that crossover, is more when the world starts commenting on what you're doing, hopefully, if you've done everything correctly.
Thanks. I love hearing that definition, because usually we hear the marketing is what you pay for and publicity isn't, but this is a much better dividing line. It really talks about where ultimately the buzz about your book is coming from. Is it coming from you? Is it coming? Mm-hmm. Are you somehow getting others to be buzzy about your book? But let me ask this too, because I don't know if it's so apparent to everyone, that let's talk about publicity. Mm-hmm. That publicity that happens before the book comes out, who is the audience for that? Are you going out to general readers saying, hey, this book will come out in 6 months and you should buy it? Or who are you actually trying to reach with that publicity?
I think you have two audiences there, right? I think, so most of the pre-publication publicity are coming from trade journals, so like reviews in PW or Feature in Kirkus, that kind of thing. So the one audience that you have are other publications, because those reviews and feature coverage are very influential in whether, you know, anything from Poets and Writers to the New York Times is going to review or, you know, otherwise cover your book. But again, anything that a legitimate outside source says about your book is great fodder for marketing your book to consumers, not just to that media audience.
Yeah, that's great. And Jay, maybe I'll just ask you just to, because again, I think some folks might just not know, just say a little bit about these trade journals. Who are the readers of these?
Right, so the trades are going to booksellers, librarians, other people inside the industry who have to make decisions about what books to stock, in what quantities, and so, you know, the Barnes & Nobles of the world or the librarians of the world will look at the starred reviews in particular, and then, so that, it can also affect pre-orders and sales figures for your book, you know, and it even determine the print run of your book. The publisher will look at that enthusiasm and use it to make some financial decisions.
And Rosamund, I'll ask you to go even one step even deeper with that. If you did anything, was there anything that you, by the way, her publisher of Nightboat, Stephen Motika, so is there anything that you and Stephen did separately or together that was aimed directly at some of these trade folks, you know, booksellers or the magazines that they read, like PW or Library Journal or anything like that, that wasn't just trying to reach potential readers before the book came out?
Well, I think that even though it's a small press, I'm very happy with Nightbow because they're about building relationships, which I think the best publishers probably are. And so they have long-standing relationships. And he said, okay, I'm going to have my meeting with Publishers Weekly, and you know the new books that are coming out, including yours, we're going to have a conversation. And I did end up getting a review in Publishers Weekly, which was great. And he tasked me with kind of contacting the people who were more in my realm. So I am. I didn't go to an MFA program, so I don't have those kind of networks. But I do teach in a college, and so I have academic friends. And for poetry, getting somebody to teach your work is a great way to sell 30 books at a time. So I contacted all of my friends and my colleagues and said, the book is coming out. Please consider teaching it in these fields, you know, Caribbean studies, African studies, women's studies, LGBTQ, et cetera, et cetera. And I actually came up with a teaching guide for the academic audience. And I also came up with kind of readers' questions, because as you might have noticed, there are non-English words in my poetry. I draw on other cultural references. And so as a way to kind of invite people in, I made sure to have both kind of discussion questions that people could ask themselves or ask each other, but also some information that would make people feel like they were a part of the book.
This is great, and we heard two different things here that are just so important, and one that's thrilling to hear about. One is that we really heard wonderfully how both the publisher and the author kind of split the work, speaking to each of their own strengths. Stephen couldn't possibly have the same academic context you do. You probably couldn't call someone at Publishers Weekly saying, "Hi, I'm a writer. Would you meet with me?" This also lets you know the difference a little bit between being published and self-publishing. Self-publishing, absolutely noble, but you kind of need to know what you're doing, and some contacts you simply may not be able to have. So you just need to know that. Although it's true, a publisher, if you are wildly successful, is also getting a bit of the cut, but they're doing an awful lot of work. So I would think, you know, we love publishers at CLMP, but there are reasons to do either one at different times. We also heard about creating a teaching guide or a study guide for the book, and this is something everyone should take note of for certain kinds of books, not every kind of book, but it's sometimes just left to the publisher. And a study guide is mostly questions about the book, right? So it's a list of 10 questions about the book. It's as easy as that, and who better than the author, who knows the answers, to come up with some questions, right? So this is something you can help your publisher with, ultimately saying, are you planning on doing a teaching guide? I have some ideas for questions about it. Or may I offer to write a teaching guide if it's something they don't normally do? Particularly for poets, I'll just say, some of you know I also run Small Press Distribution. It is true that the bread and butter of poetry publishers in particular, for longevity of a book, is academic sales. It means course adoption. Something like fiction, I think, is more about you get the word out, the book sells real fast, and then other books kind of come along, and then until you probably publish another book, it's harder to keep the momentum going. But poetry books are a little more long tail. They will sell a little bit, maybe you get some buzz and sell a bunch, and then over many years they can build momentum because they're being taught. Fiction books are not taught in quite the same way usually, sometimes.
They're not. I mean, I would say that there's another kind of marketing avenue that novelists can contribute to, which is, for some people, there are course adoptions, especially if you're addressing kind of big issues like war or, you know, things that might fit into things like, you know, LGBTQ studies classes. But for book groups, having a reading group guide, I mean, this is the kind of consumer version of the, you know, of the study guide that you have for a book. And I also think that for certain kinds of novels that address certain kinds of issues, there are first-year experience programs, and there is a whole conference for first-year experience that there is a ton of marketing of books to. Those books are generally books that have been incredibly successful, really, really broken out as novels or memoirs or, you know, works of nonfiction, but a way to sell thousands and thousands of copies.
You also heard with Rosamond, you talked about the categories. You were talking about an academic setting, but works in a bookstore too. Mm-hmm. Your book might fall into, and you didn't just pick one, you had like five.
Right.
And, you know, every time, every one of these categories, you might think you're narrowing your focus, but in fact, by coming up with those, you were broadening your audiences. So I think that's sometimes counterintuitive. People who have come to any workshop I've ever given have heard me say this: the more narrowly you focus, the more people you will reach. Because to say this book is for anyone who has ever heard a story means that, why not read Proust? Why not, you know, it could be anybody. So by creating a clear context for the book or a clear readership for the book, even if there are 10 of them, potential readers kind of know, oh, that might be for me.
I think just to add on to that, one of the most frustrating things that I ever hear from an author or an agent is that this book is for everyone. And a book is, if you want to get really crass about it, it's a one-off product, right? It's not a part of a whole line. You don't have brand awareness. You are creating a new audience every single time. So if you can't define that audience in some way, you will never reach it. And there's a hand-in-hand comment that comes there that's, I want to think out of the box. I'm like, the time to think out of the box about marketing your book is after you've already reached your target market. If you're reaching your target market and you've been successful in that, then the concentric circles of the other tangential markets will be much more easy to get to. But if you don't get in the sweet spot of the tennis racket, you're never going to get anyone.
Right, so you're saying don't start by trying to be clever, start by actually going to your most likely readers.
Absolutely.
So maybe with that, maybe this is a good time to jump to something that many of you have heard of. Who is aware of something called the author questionnaire? Oh, not that, that's great, not that many of you. So when you do get to a publisher, they're going to hand you something called an author questionnaire. It's a questionnaire, just like that. We have three here. And Jane, why don't you tell them in a second where they can find a bunch of others, which is great. Jane, I should tell you, is a living resource of many other resources. And it's just janefriedman.com?
Yeah, at janefriedman.com you can find author questionnaire samples as well as query letter samples, synopsis samples, book proposal samples.
So these questionnaires, you'll be able to, we're going to read a little bit of them, but you can see a whole bunch of different examples. They're all mostly kind of the same, and I was just joking that the last 5 questions are always a little different. The first 25 are kind of the same. But so I'll just say a bit about what the beginning is, and then I thought, well, just bop around, and I'll hand you this one, Jane. This one's from Riverhead. We have one from Nightboat. And Nicole, yours is from?
This one is from Little Brown. And
from Little Brown.
Here's another one for Jane, too.
Oh, great. Okay. So I thought the first part is the most basic information: name, address, citizenship, are you married, do you have children, religious affiliation. And some of these might seem odd, like why do you care? But why would we want to know an author's religious affiliation? Why might that possibly be useful?
I'll give you one perfect example. I've marketed to a wide variety of religious affiliations, but there's one that happens every year at Jewish book fairs. There's a network of JCCs and synagogues around the country, and many of them host book events throughout the year, but in November they have a huge nationwide Jewish book fairs. These venues just select the authors that they're going to host. They fly the authors to these places and pay for their expenses, and they have a very smart, targeted reading audience that they, fill rooms and auditoriums for authors and sell a ton of books for them, and at the expense of the JCCs rather than the author or the publisher. Who wouldn't want that?
Yeah, and similarly, it will ask, do you belong to an alumni association? And same deal. Some of these things are what I like to call adventures into the obvious, which are always the most daring adventures to take, which is because we skip over them sometimes. And, If you have a degree, you have an alumni association, and they should be one of the first folks who know that you've published a book, because they're hungry for material for those magazines that for them are really ways to get you to write checks to the school, right?
And but, some of those alumni organizations have, for bigger universities, have alumni clubs in every town, and I've had, I've had an author on a 20-city tour who is doing an evening event and a breakfast event, and then, at lunchtime, the Barnard Club or the Harvard Club or whatever is hosting a separate event, also sometimes at their expense and with a lot of additional marketing through their newsletters and their magazines and the local newsletters.
So we're going to read through some of these questions in just a bit, but I want to ask a question. I know the answer, but I'm going to have someone else answer it, which is an author who's never seen one of these might think, oh my God, they're asking me 31 questions. Isn't it their job to do the marketing? Why are they making me fill out this form with all this information and provide mailing lists and names of important people and lists of newspapers? Aren't they supposed to know that? So why is an author being asked to do this? Are they doing the work of the publisher?
We'll answer from the author's perspective.
Thank you.
I don't know if I will ever have another book. I want people to read my book. And it is a lot of work to do the marketing side. I always say if I ever write a memoir, it's going to be called Do I Have to Fry the Chicken Too? You know, you wrote the book, you like poured out your soul into the book, but then you want people to read it. And the author questionnaire that I received was 5 pages long. When I returned it, it was 26 pages long. And Nightboat publishes between 8 and 12 books a year. And they love all of their authors, but they have told me that they have authors who return a 5-page questionnaire and who say things like, I'm too shy to do interviews. And there's not that much that they can do to help the author get that book into readers' hands, whereas I gave them so much information. You know, and I'm so persistent, always saying, is there a reading? Is there a reading? So I'm not doing a reading with them at AWP this year because they're highlighting, my book was published last year, and they're highlighting people who are published this year. But because I reached out to them and they did some work on my behalf, I have a reading coming up in June with, it's a collaborative reading with another organization. So that you are helping the press do their work, but I see it as my work because I want people to read this book that I worked so hard on.
And this is one of these adventures into the obvious. Who could possibly know more about your book than you? You wrote it. They didn't write it. You wrote it. So some of these questions, you might think, well, aren't they supposed to figure this out? You already know it. And it's not, hey, they're supposed to do it. They're actually working for you, so give them all the possible tools. So we're just going to jump around, and let's just pick out some questions. So the first ones are these kind of brass tacks. Please list local newspapers. Do you have a local bookstore you like to go to? Things like that. But let's jump to the more slightly more creative ones, and we'll all just zip around, and let's just read out a few of these. And then you can go to Jane's website, pull out some others, and I'm sure if you have friends who have been published, ask for copies of their author questionnaires.
I'll just pull out two, and one of them is a super obvious one, which is, what's your birth date? And I can't tell you how many people don't answer this question. And I'm not going to put your birth date on the Jumbotron in Times Square, but your publisher does want to submit you for awards, and they need that information for pretty much every award that they submit to, and if you won't give it to them, then they can't submit you for, say, the National Book Award. So give them your birthday. And one of the other questions that a lot of people don't answer, or I think answer poorly, is there are there any comp titles for your book? Are there any other books that you consider similar to your own? So this is a way of framing the audience for your book. And if you can't bear the idea of getting there, they're going to do it for you, and you may not like the way that they frame it. So I think if you can really dig deep within yourself and say, it's like Atonement meets, Where'd You Go, Bernadette, then you give them something to work with, and they can work with you on that definition. But having so little time for consumers to, be looking at a listing for your book on a website, having so little time with media people to convince them why they need to crack open the cover, if you can use those comp titles to frame those books, and it gives you a sentence in which you can do that, and it's kind of back to the elevator pitch, defining your audience, you are giving them the tools to sell your book.
And don't just pick 2 all-time best-selling mega hit books, because that's actually not helpful. Something more, in fact, by the way, if anyone here has written a book that is kind of Atonement meets Where'd You Go, Bernadette, call me because I'm your reader. There you go.
Me too.
So Jane, you want to just pick out a fun question?
That was the one I was going to talk about.
I'll
build on that and say that sometimes what we call lookalike media are also interesting to talk about. So TV shows, movies, anything in the pop culture that you know that the people who love Orange is the New Black is just, they're going to love your story of imprisonment. This is something that you could also perhaps talk about as a way to market, advertise when you as your pitch line. So you don't necessarily have to just limit yourself to books, although that's where the publisher is going to start.
And Rosamond, let me ask you, from a writer's perspective, was there a question that either you found very surprising to be asked or that you found particularly helpful to be asked because you wouldn't have thought to put that down and hand to your publisher, and it was useful?
Yeah, it's kind of a long question, but it reads as follows. Attaching the author's personality to his or her book can be useful for marketing to sales reps, booksellers, and readers, as well as for garnering media attention. Regarding your biographical data, please help us create a personal character sketch of you, one that depicts you as someone with human features, interests, hobbies, idiosyncrasies, pets, pet peeves, a home, a family, etc., in addition to the more standard professional biographical data that you've already supplied. If you have trouble with this, imagine how a close friend might describe you.
So you should take your Hello Cupid ad, OK Cupid ad, and attach it. So let me ask this to our PR marketing people. So why would we need to know things about the writer as a human outside of what they wrote? Why would that be useful?
I'm happy to take that one, and I'm sure that Jane is too. So in my work as a publicist, one of the best things that I can do for a book is get somebody an interview on NPR. And I work with a lot of novelists. So it's super easy when I am talking about nonfiction because there are facts to talk about. There's often history that informs it or current events that people are informed about. So following a discussion about something that you already know something about is pretty easy for the audience. Imagine an interviewer interviewing somebody about a novel that nobody in the audience has read. So some of your personality is in there, and this is something that I work with a lot, authors with a lot on, because whether your fiction is autobiographical or not, there is some part of you in every bit of writing that you do. What I like so much about the question that Rosamond's publisher has asked her is, she is being asked to give away those parts of herself that she's comfortable giving away. If you shut down an interviewer, it makes the interviewer not like you, and it also makes the audience not like you. And I've had people who have a tremendous amount of personal backstory that informs their fiction or their nonfiction shut down an interviewer when it comes to that, and I've had like a fresh air interview not air because of that. So I think deciding ahead of time and really thinking about what parts of your personal life and your personality that you are openly willing to give to the world, you don't have to give them anything else, but you do really have to give them something if you want to engage with the audience. And that's how that audience responds to you as a person and wants to read your book, because if you do nothing but talk about the plot and that, I mean, you can see why that's a problem too. So it's helping to solve the problem of how you talk about fiction in particular, but writing in general, and connecting with an audience that, you know, probably hasn't known you before.
Yeah, Jane, can you add a little more about how things that are not the book itself might be used that have to do with the author or anything else that sort of isn't really what's inside the covers of the book toward gaining readers for it that might be used that come from these questionnaires?
Do you mean the bio? Or
yeah, the bio or anything else. Themes in the book.
Yeah, I don't have a good answer.
That's okay. But I think, you know, as much as you talk about it, it's not
I mean, I do. I think, you know, I mean, I think that there are, you know, there are a million other ways that you can skin this cat, right? So so this is a perfect example. I worked on Kevin Power's debut novel, The Yellow Birds. And he was a soldier in Iraq. He was writing a novel about
two kids that go to war, and the novel is attempting to answer the question, what is it like over there? So one of the things that he had in his author questionnaire that was when he was at the Mitchell Center doing his MFA, he was also teaching veterans poetry, and his MFA was in poetry. And I got him a feature in a major national magazine that wasn't really about the book. It was really just about teaching veterans poetry and what that did for him. If he hadn't told me that, there's no way that I could have made that happen. And there are so many other ways. Like, I mean, I worked with tons of novelists who have food in their books, or even if they don't have food in their books, they're just avid cooks and been able to get features or feature their recipes or their cooking on their social media, and it kind of connects them to a broader audience. So there's lots of different ways that those things can be mined.
Yeah, just a quick note, there's some advice that I hear frequently that I think is on target is pick the three things you want to talk about on social media or in the world, and you keep going back to those again and again, whether it's cooking, bourbon, and
knitting.
Yeah, so that you start to be associated with those things. It gives you a point of relationship or commonality with those who you know, see you online in particular. I get more questions about bourbon than writing, I feel like, because it's in my bio and people glom onto that because it's something they know and they want to discuss.
Yeah, but then you become a go-to person if they want someone sort of literary to say something about bourbon.
Precisely.
So why not?
Sure.
Why is bourbon in your bio?
It's not so much what she has in her own bio, but people say about her. But we'll hold that for another. Over a drink, we'll talk about that. I'm going to throw one more in, and Rosamund, I'm curious if you had this one on your questionnaire from Stephen. Here's one I have from Riverhead. What compelled you to write this book? I've seen that on a lot of them. Did you have to say sort of what led to writing the book?
Yes, I think there's one, it's not worded exactly the same, but very similar. And I would second what you said, that, you know, there were some things I didn't want to share. But I did, you know, I did kind of craft a story to share about why I wrote the book, where it came from, how it got published, etc.
Yeah, and I've seen it. There's a number of questions, we don't have to read them off, that they're all similar, kind of, why did you become a writer? What writers inspire you? Sort of giving a context for your own literary influences. And that seems like, that's also something else that would be great to throw in to a potential reviewer or live, you know, radio reviewer, so that they have stuff to ask you beyond what happens next in the book.
And I'll actually say, I really wish I had seen an author questionnaire before I got published, because I would have included some of this information in my query letters to publishers, and I think it would not have taken me as long to get published.
Thank you for saying that, because I was going to suggest, and it's so great that I would, as an exercise, I would recommend all of you download some of these questionnaires, fill them out now, even if you don't have a book done. Fill it out now, because you're going to be ready to go, and then you'll fine-tune it at the point that you actually have a publisher. I think it would be a really great exercise.
For example, in your query letter, if you can tell your publisher, you know, three authors who you are close personal friends with or that you were in a writing workshop with and they have already agreed to give you a blurb for your book, that is super important information. Don't leave that out. And I think doing this exercise will remind you of the ways in which you can let them know how you're already poised to market this work.
And maybe that's a good segue. Maybe that's a good next topic, which is blurbs for books. Many of us, I know I do, if I'm in a bookstore and there are those books on the front table that either the bookstore picked out or someone paid to put there, you know, and you're thinking, what should I read? You pick them up, and what do? You flip them over and look at the back, or at least I do. And those blurbs, you know, it's not that I, it makes the book better that someone fancy blurbed the book, but if the people on the back of the book are people that I already read, then I think I'm a reader for the book. For me, that's how it works. But Rosamund, you have blurbs on the back of your book. Who got the blurbs? So the question is, who's responsible for getting the blurbs, and how does that happen?
I got the blurbs, and I was told that the writers would be more likely to respond to me than to the publisher. And I asked six people, and three said yes. two of the people who I wrote to, people said they never give blurbs. And one of those people, in fact, never gave a blurb, and one of those people did give a blurb. I wrote a handwritten 3-page letter to one of my favorite poets of all time, and she agreed to blurb
and
the book.
So you didn't know her? She wasn't a friend, or
she's
didn't study
friend.
With her?
I've seen her, like I've
yeah.
met her.
But it wasn't like you're saying, hey, you know.
Yeah, no.
Hey, former teacher of mine, would you write a blurb? Right, so, and also I've heard story after story of people writing to authors that they genuinely really idolize and have really had influence on them, has to be real. These things pass the sniff test, they really do. Writing and just giving a heartfelt, what your work has meant to me and would you consider blurbing my book, and getting blurbs from some pretty damn fancy people who they've never met, that maybe they saw, you know, give a reading, but they don't know them. And don't think you, it doesn't matter if you studied with fancy people or not, is the lesson. But do publishers also get blurbs?
Yeah, they do. And I mean, it's interesting. Sometimes I think authors are offended by their publishers asking them to get blurbs. One of the things that I always tell authors about who they should contact and who they shouldn't contact, in general, somebody that you have a personal relationship with probably wants to hear from you directly rather than your publisher. If you don't, it can kind of go other way. Like if you, you know, and it also might depend upon your publisher, who your publisher is. If your editor or your publisher is a super fancy person and they have lots of relationships, that can open doors. If your publisher publishes other authors who are super fancy, it's very easy to open doors that way. I mean, there are people that I've worked with, you know, for years and years and years, over 20 plus years, that I can, you know, I can send them an email and say, can I send this to you or not? And they're like, yes, no, or maybe, but I may not even open it. And but as far as blurbs go, it's a kind of a group effort, and I think it's good to have a really open dialogue and be open to really working hard to get them. And it sounds like it pays off. And I've heard so many stories, especially from authors, writing directly to that writing hero, even if they don't get a blurb. Like I have an author who got, you know, a 2-page handwritten letter back from John Updike. He will have that for the rest of his life, right? And that was so incredibly meaningful to him. So he didn't get a blurb that he could put on his book, but I would say that effort paid off.
I think it's also, I mean, in general, it's helpful to be part of the literary community and just kind of have a sense of who are nice people. because I've also heard stories of people who got blurbs from fancy people that weren't great blurbs. Mm-hmm. And then they were stuck in like, oh, we asked this person to do this. They're going to be offended if we don't put this on the back of the book. And the people who are on the back of my book, their work is important to me. They're not the most famous people in the world, but they also said really great things. They really read the book closely, and it wasn't like, oh, this is great. It was like, this is why it's great. This is what's interesting about it. And knowing people who are in kind of my literary community, this was, because this week, this was revealed to me, like, you don't know which of those people who read your book are sitting on committees to give out awards and give out residencies and things mm-hmm. like that.
I will say that you can also, if you have personal relationships, and this is something that I think people are very, very hesitant about, like say you already have 2 blurbs and say your book is, this is a good example, say your book is really targeted towards women readers and you have 2 blurbs from men and they're great, but they don't really say some key element of it. If you know someone well and they're like, yeah, I'm happy to blurb your book, and a lot of times people will say, do you want to make changes to this, or do you have any edits? And you can say that. You can say, we're really hoping for somebody to say this kind of thing about the book. Are you okay with that? If you don't ask, you don't get. And that's something that you have to kind of be aware of what your relationship with is. With that person and how far that you can go, but it happens a lot.
Yeah, I would say it's worth thinking about. I'll use the sort of corporate word end user, meaning the reader. Thinking about your potential reader, which is whose name is going to be meaningful for the kind of reader that you think will really enjoy your book, because you may have a connection to a famous person. You know, maybe you went to school and they taught there and you know them. But if they're a mystery writer and you're writing, you know. Something, I can't think of anything else, something very, very different, a sci-fi book, their blurb, while their name might be famous, is not going to be very meaningful to a reader of sci-fi, necessarily. So think about yourself picking up a book. You know, whose name would be meaningful to you who don't know you, if you can do that. Split personality test in blurbing your book. So it works both ways that way. But I want to just say something along what Rosamond said, because it's just nice to say it every one of these, about being nice to people. Being a good literary citizen is so incredibly important. I've said this at other workshops, but you know, successful publishing comes about because it is a karmic activity. And there are many people involved. These are group efforts. And more than just author and publisher, there are many, many people involved. Booksellers, librarians, academics, all these folks together are part of your publishing team, even if you don't meet some of them, they really are. And people know each other. People come to conferences. People you don't think may know each other. People sit on judging committees. Be nice to everyone. Be generous. And I think this will be a segue into social media and how it works well. So is social media important for writers?
I feel like I've... it can be, but it doesn't have to be. So one of the challenges here is that if your publisher or your agent or whomever says, oh, you now have a book coming out, get on Twitter, and you've never done it before, you're likely not going to do anything that's effective. Unless you have like an actual interest and this is the spurring moment for you where you're actually going to start using it in a way that's enjoyable. So, you know, we can tell when someone's on social media just to sell or because someone told them to go do it. And usually you're not going to do it for long enough or joyfully enough for it to be sustainable. So that's one of kind of like the paradoxes here.
No, thanks for saying that, because it is true. It has to be something you really do. You might do it a little better, do more of it. But if it's something you don't engage in, I'm not saying don't try it. We're not saying that. But don't think you have to. Right. But if you do it, do it better. So let's talk about how to do it better. I do want to say one thing about the word marketing, because it's an icky word for so many of us. It is often for me. But there's a difference between being marketed at and marketing in the terms of what the way Rosamond described it, which is sharing what you're doing. If it is genuinely sharing what you're doing, marketing is a good thing. It's how people know what you're doing. If you market at people, that's kind of icky. And the example I like to give is, imagine being at a cocktail party, and someone comes up to you that you've never met, and you say, hi, you know, who are you? You introduce each other, and what do you do is what you say to the other person. And then they then talk at you until you are forced to back away about themselves. That's being marketed at. If they tell you something about themselves and they say, and what do you do? That's good marketing. Anyone wants just to add to general principles of being a good literary citizen?
I really like that. I use that too sometimes. The picking three things, and three things in the world other than just your writing that you're talking about. And finding the platform that you're comfortable on. You don't have to be on every platform. It's probably a waste of your time. You're probably not going to be good at all of them because they require different things of people. And maybe also being cognizant of what platform most readers of the kinds of books that you do are on, because there is, you know, there is some difference there. And the other thing about using social media is, even if you're not on it, your publisher is on it, and you can help them, find images that speak to your book, you know, pull quotes that are, you know, I mean, there's a lot of things that can be done in that way through somebody else's platform, you know, friends of yours that are writers, or, you know, journalists who write about books, or, you know, and otherwise influential to the particular audience that you're speaking to. It doesn't all have to come from you.
Yeah, the my publisher every month sends us an email and says, what are you doing in the next month? And then they will tweet it out, and they will put it on their Facebook page. So if you're on Twitter, you can retweet what they did. You don't even have to write the tweet. If you're not on Twitter, then they're tweeting it for you. Rita Dove says every poet should write one review a year of another poet. And I think it's a good idea to think about doing one big thing a year, whether that's organizing an event where other people read and you also read, or writing a review, doing something for someone else. And I also think for social media, the way that works is for every three things that you tweet or put on Facebook about yourself, support somebody else. Say, oh, this my friend put out this book that's amazing, or they got a review, because that's part of being a part of a literary community. Then people are less likely to think you're only tweeting about yourself all the time, and also more likely to share the things that you have put out about your work.
Yeah, and this seems so obvious, but if you had said something really nice about someone else's book coming out, when yours comes out, you know, they just may say something nice about yours. That's how it works. I think rather than, I could ask plenty more questions, and I will if no one has any questions, but I hope you do. I think we'll take some questions now. So. Put your hand up. Try to keep your question concise because I want to be able to repeat it so everyone can hear it. So I saw your hand go up right away. Yeah.
So I recently designed a website because everyone seems to have one. And I wanted to ask you about the blog portion of the website. Say, for example, I wanted to talk about someone else's poetry book. I don't know how that media connects. How does my blog get out there?
That's a great question. So the question was, in general, I'm going to make it two parts. So one is just, does an author need a website? I'm going to ask that as a most general, or is it useful to have one? And then, if an author has a website, virtually any website out there has a blogging feature, and how might an author use that blogging feature if they want to write about other authors? How does that get out there? How would anyone know that they did that, right? So, how do you be the tree falling in the forest that other people hear?
Sure. I recommend every author have a website, period. And it doesn't have to be fancy. You don't have to hire a designer or a developer. I think a basic WordPress site works fine for most people, especially early in their career. Don't overthink it. And the title of the website should be the name you publish under. Don't make it your book title, just the name you publish under. And then blogging is optional. Like, just because you have a website doesn't mean you have to update it all the time with new content. Just think of it as a business card that people in the media, journalists, reviewers, publicists, all these people have, like, this one place they can go for the story on you and your work. So it's your turf, and you control it, and you can get them to use the copy that you write to describe you in your book. But if you want your blog to be read, this is a very long, slow process, and you have to be thinking about why people read things online, what makes them click, and then also using imagery, because the way that most of us find stuff right now is through social media. So it has to look appealing to click on Facebook or Twitter or, you know, whatever it is, whatever network you're on. The other way is to get other people in your community, influencers, whomever, to talk about it and link to it if you don't have much of a social media presence yourself. If you're doing book reviews, which is excellent, I would consider cross-posting on Goodreads, because that will also help you get more traffic and attention for it.
So what you're hearing is that you simply writing a blog doesn't mean they will come, but you have to just connect it through other social media, and even better, get other people to say, hey, look, there's a blog posting about this. Rosemont, do you have a website?
I do have a website. I don't update it as often as I would like, but I do have a website. And it's, you know, most of us have jobs. We have to work. And so it's, as I said, it's a lot of work to do these things. But if you have a website, and things like having a picture of myself, a headshot on the website, means that people won't email me six times saying, I need a headshot for that reading that we're doing in 6 months, but I need it now for the marketing. I'm like, I forgot to do it, you know. So it's I think it's not just a business card, it's actually your whole press package in some ways for the book.
And does your publisher also have a separate page for you, or is your page like the page for the book?
They have my publisher has a page.
They also
as well,
have a book page.
And there's a page on Small Press Distribution, which for a lot of small, you can probably explain better than me, a lot of small presses use Small Press Distribution.
Right. Well, for those who don't know, I'll say quickly because I run it. Small Press Distribution is the world's only nonprofit literary book distributor, and we distribute some 400 small presses. So particularly if you're a poet, you probably move through SPD. And if you're writing work in translation or experimental fiction or maybe cultural studies, good chance that you're moving through the SPD warehouse. But visit us at spdbooks.org.
It's on the back of my postcard.
Oh, and it's on the back of Rosamond's postcard. A question here.
Yeah,
That's a great question. So the question is, if an author does want to do a blog, who's written a book, does it need to be a literary blog, or can it be about anything?
I mean, I think it can be about anything, but ideally, if you want it to serve a marketing purpose, it's going to appeal to the same audience that will read your work. So I think that's the critical piece for this panel, anyway.
Right, but it doesn't. I don't think it has to be particularly literary. I mean, if your book is a novel where someone fishes, if you kept a blog about fishing, that would make sense. It should probably be aligned, but it doesn't have to be reviewing books or be high literary criticism or anything like that, really. But I think that's the key, is the reader the same reader?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Let me give you an example.
Well, actually, I'm sorry, I'm going to go on to other questions. So there were so many hands up, but we'll stick around a little bit at the end. Way back there. Yeah. Great, thank you. So the question, I'll repeat, we've talked about saying that a book is for any kind of reader is not terribly useful, because that really means it's for nobody. Mm-hmm. And I was saying the more narrowly you focus, the more people you will reach. So even in saying something like this is for women seems still too broad, perhaps. So are there any kinds of ways to think about, say, keywords or groups, or what might be some tactics for figuring out how to define your audience?
I would start by looking at comp titles or comp authors on Goodreads. And then, I don't know if you've noticed on Goodreads, but readers can tag the books with keywords, how they think about the book, which I feel that's a really critical piece of learning how to talk about your book to readers specifically, is using the language that they use. And you can figure that out by going on Goodreads and seeing how books get tagged. Reading reviews on Amazon or Goodreads is also helpful, because you see some of the same phrases used again and again, and how readers are thinking about this and how they find the next book or what they love about the book. That will get you narrow really quickly.
It sounds like if an author were to come up with a longer list, it wouldn't be public necessarily, but of comp titles, and then do this exercise of looking each of them up on mm-hmm. Goodreads and Amazon, and then saying what do they all have in common, that might be useful.
I think also thinking your statement about women thinks about audience, but I think also thinking about content and about form. So, you know, if you're writing about, if you think about Wild, right, that it's about the outdoors, it's about women who are adventurous, right, thinking about things like that. And then about form, a friend of mine who's writing her first novel, her mantra is that she is writing a serious beach novel. Right? So she wants it to be serious, but she wants it to be fun enough that people feel like mm-hmm. they can just kind of pick it up and read it, not one of those kind of ponderous, serious literary novels. And so thinking about your form can also help narrow that.
That's great. I also want to read that book. Yes, right here.
Do you keep email lists and U.S. post office address lists? That seems to me there's so many ways we can talk to people that I can't decide which lists are worth keeping.
Right, so I'll just repeat the question is... do we have to keep multiple snail mail lists and email lists, and how does one keep track of all that kind of stuff, and what's most important there?
Yes.
That's what I mean.
Yes. I mean, you want to be able to contact people in every way that you can contact people. I mean, so much of marketing and outreach is done digitally, but, you know, when you're talking about a book, the best way to market the book is with the book, and so you want to be able to at least to keep people get copies of the book in their hands, and the snail mail address is really important then.
You know, I'm gonna share one, and I think probably everyone has one of these. I was gonna end with this, but we'll do it now and then we'll take more questions. Would everyone share one guerrilla, simple, free tactic for having people know about your book? The one I'm gonna say is the signature of your own email, auto, you know, signature. If you have a book out, that book better, there better be a link to buy your book down there in every response to an email you give automatically. That's so easy and free, and I'm shocked when friends have written books and their signature doesn't say, buy my book, and something about it and a link.
I would say don't forget your friends and family, even if they're not, you know, I write weird experimental poetry, and a lot of people in my family bought the book and will never read it, and that's okay because they love me and they bought the book.
Use your book cover liberally everywhere. in your Facebook profile background, in the Twitter background, on your website, on the homepage. Do not hide the cover everywhere.
And I think that this is just kind of back to the very beginning of our conversation. When people ask you what you do or what you're working on, I'm with authors at cocktail parties, and they're like, "Well, that was like, I'm working on a novel about thus and such. I'm writing a collection of poetry that explores these issues," and be able to articulate that in a sentence or two. And please don't ever say, "It's really hard to explain."
That's great advice. Let's take another question right here.
So I had a question about blurbs, and what do you guys think about if you have people from other art forms writing blurbs? Like, for example, I have a YA book about someone who wants to be a filmmaker. I went to film school with Barry Jenkins, who co-wrote and directed Moonlight, and it's an LGBT book. Would
yes.
that be a good
book? Yeah, so just the answer is yes, but the question, just for the sake of everyone hearing it, is do my blurbs have to be from other writers, or can they be from people in other art forms that makes sense for the book? And the answer is yes. Yeah, it could be a TV personality. It could be anyone, a famous chef, if your book is about food. It just has to make sense. Again, is the audience for this person, do they overlap in a Venn diagram with the audience for my book? And then the answer is yes. Yeah, any? Great, another question? There. Okay, I'm gonna phrase a question for everyone, and I think I'll keep this one narrow because it's an interesting problem. If you're writing, say, a YA book or a children's book, beyond other writers in that community, or maybe even booksellers or teachers, how do you actually connect with the readers of a book like that, where they're not going to be necessarily your friends, you know, children in other states of people you don't know? How do you find those sort of readers?
Well, one of my best friends is Zeta Elliott, ZettaElliott.com. She's a wonderful YA novelist, and she is largely self-published and lives completely off of her writing. And I actually think that teachers are a really wonderful way, because part of how she makes her money is through teacher visits. Visits to classrooms, and then they buy 30 books or 100 books or 300 books for every kid in the school or every kid in that grade. And then because it's very tricky to have interactions with people who are under 18. And so, it's not my experience, but she does not pursue social media relationships with young people. She does not try to find them directly. It's really largely through schools. And then a lot of times kids will write to her after that, but she still doesn't friend them. She'll respond via email, but it's largely through the schools, through the school librarians also, but through teachers and school librarians is how Zeta does it.
That's great advice. So in the same way that a book that might have some academic legs, let's say, you're not trying to reach the students directly, you're really trying to go to the professors. For younger readers, it's reaching teachers and parents, probably, so that you're not crossing lines of legality.
And I don't like this word because it's loaded, but they really are the gatekeepers for children. And in that particular case, they should remain the gatekeepers for children.
Sometimes the baby gatekeepers. Another question. I saw one way over here. Yeah. Thank you for that prompt. Let's talk about elevator pitches. Someone want to define what an elevator pitch is?
Sure. I mean, I think you want to be able to describe your book to somebody in two, maybe three sentences. It's a little bit like what Jeffrey asked us to do with our own introductions. Can I, like, if it takes me more than a minute or even 30 seconds to tell you what I do, you're going to tune out. And if you can't describe, if it takes you more time than that to describe what you're writing to somebody, they're not going to want to read it.
And I'll say in general, if you're writing fiction and what you think is your elevator pitch has in it, and then this happens, and then work on it again. The name comes from the idea that you're on an elevator, a friend you haven't seen in years gets on the elevator on the second floor, this is for illustration purposes only, and says, "Hey, what's up?" And you say, "Well, I'm writing a book." And they say, "What's it about?" And you have until they reach floor 7 to tell them. before they walk off. If you can't do that, you don't know what your book is about.
You really don't. And you can say, I mean, you can use the, like, the kind of classic Hollywood, you know, it's like Die Hard, you know, meets Pretty Woman. I'm good at these, you guys. and that, like, it's a good framing element for people, right? Because people know what these pop culture things are. That may not be a way that you can talk about your experimental fiction, right, or your poetry. But you know, Rosamund did a really good job of explaining what she's doing in her book very quickly.
And by the way, without telling you exactly, really, what's in it. You didn't quote a line from your own book. You didn't say it's made up of a certain number of poems. But you gave me the themes. What you told me was, why might I care about it? Why might I want to read it? It should answer those questions. So it doesn't have to repeat the plot. It doesn't have to say exactly how many pages or that even its poems, quite frankly. But it should tell me as a reader who has interest, what interest might align with my own.
Right, and I'll go back to the book that I talked about earlier, Kevin Powers, The Yellow Birds, and the way that I described it. He's a former soldier who wrote a book about two kids who go to war trying to answer the question of what it's like over there. You know exactly who the reader for that book is.
Right, but exactly what happened in that book, we don't know. But it doesn't matter because that's interesting to those who probably want to actually read the book and will love the book. So think about it in that way. Also, if you go to Amazon, you can use Amazon as a database in a really nice way. There is something called the long description and the short description of a book. Look at the short description. And you all do this. You all look at readers who read this book, read that, and you click on it and you read the short description, right? That's an elevator pitch. I think we have time for one more question. Right there. Oh, great, great question. So the value of hiring a publicist, and if you didn't see it, there was a nice little piece in Lit Hub 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. You could go find it, about working with publicists. It tells you what they cost and names a few people. So look that one up on lithub.com. But someone want to talk about hiring a freelance publicist? So you're not talking about a publisher having a publicist. You're talking about, as a writer, whether you have a publisher or not, hiring a publicist.
First, it's going to cost a lot of money, and you shouldn't expect to earn that back through book sales. It's going to be more of a long-term investment in raising your profile as an author, and some of the effects that will spill out over years, if it's a good publicist yeah. that you're hiring and they're doing good work. Have a very specific goal in mind when you hire a publicist, other than sell books. Like, you want to reach a very particular audience, or you want to raise your profile with this particular group of people, or you would like to see the book get attention in this community, because that gives them something to sink their teeth into, because just selling more books is not a great goal to go to a publicist with.
Right, and it's, and Nicole, you, as a publicist, you can probably answer more, but it's not just, can you get me 5 reviews?
Right, and the thing that I would never tell somebody is that I can get them anything. What I can do as a publicist, and this is, you know, this is my work, I'm a freelance publicist, I can get you answers, and we should have clear targets. The scope of work that I'm doing for you should be focused on the things that are going to have the biggest impact on growing your readership, on reaching your audience, and building your profile and your credentials as an author. So they should all kind of be contributing to those things. But the fact is, it's not the publicist who decides. It's the media or the bookseller or the outlet that we're going to. And you know, you can build it, and they can not come. So one of the things you have to accept, and this is something that I have to say super clearly to every, I don't have to say it so much with publishers because they know this, but certainly when authors hire me directly, you can hire me to do this, and none of it can happen. And then you still have to pay me because I've done the work. So that's something you have to be, you know, you have to be prepared for. And some of the reasons why people hire an outside publicist, some publishers are really clear about the amount of marketing and promotion they will do for your book, and you may want more than that. And Some people want a dedicated person that they can really collaborate with, and that's something that you can pay for. And then the reasons why publishers hire outside publicists are a whole different ball of wax.
And I think you have to be realistic. I mean, you can spend $30,000 on a publicist for one book for 1 year. And somebody was telling me, oh, you know, there's this publicist and she can virtually guarantee that you can get into O Magazine. And assuming that that is true, how many times has Oprah picked a poetry book for her book club? How many times has O Magazine had a poetry book in the magazine? How many times have they had an experimental book of poetry in the magazine? And so you have to really know your work. And are my readers reading O Magazine? You know, I'm not sure that they are. But I also think, you know, publicists or professionals are very good at what they do. And if you have something really targeted, like maybe it is O Magazine, or maybe it's Sailors Weekly, because you're writing about ships. And if you can get to Sailors Weekly, you will probably sell 500 copies of your book. So they can do really targeted strategies that will cost you less money and could have this kind of long-term thing. You know, just, you probably know this, but, you know, I'm not making any money off of my book, right? I'm super happy that it's in the world. And I'm happy that the publisher gets the majority of the money because they keep putting out my book and doing work for it and put out other good books. But what I do get is reading fees and speaking fees. And what I charge for that has actually doubled over the last year as, you know, my profile gets bigger and more people ask me to do things. And so, and I look at some of that as using some of that money to then plow back into other things that relate to either my career or the book specifically. So I don't know if that's helpful.
I think that's really helpful. And, you know, and it's similar to the way that we were talking about on the sending out side, that your book isn't just what's between the covers, it's also all of you. That what is to be gained from publishing a book isn't just unit sales. And in fact, much of it, particularly for certain kinds of books, it isn't about unit sales at all. It's about getting you out there, ultimately. So
right.
It's a nice balanced.
I will add one other thing to that. I worked with a writer last fall who was trying to get tenure. And he really had a sense that trying to get a tenure-track job. He had been teaching writing for a long time, and he hadn't published something. This was his first book, and he was investing in getting more coverage to impress the committee for. And he got a tenure-track job 6 weeks after the book published. That was a really good investment for him because it's a long-term investment. And one of the other things that I will say about the ways in which people pay us as freelance publicists, you know, I'm working with a guy who's published by, you know, a big five publishing house, but he teaches writing and just took a new job at a very well-endowed university, and they have given him some money for various things. And he asked, could it be used for an outside publicist? Because raising his profile is good for that institution. So he's not paying me out of his pocket, he's paying me out of Brown's pocket. And the same thing is true for people that work at NGOs and in various other things like that. You get grants that you can use to hire people like us because it's good for the organization, it serves the mission, and all sorts of things like that.
Yeah, and it is it's an investment in a longer view, right? It's not just selling a bunch of copies of a book, which ultimately is, I hope, what no one is focused on. We don't have time for any more questions. I just have time to thank my gorgeous panel. Thank you so much.